In 1935, fascist Italy attacked Ethiopia, weakening the League of Nations, of which both Ethiopia and Italy were members. Juridically, there is a very direct parallel between that attack on Ethiopia and the attack by the United States on Iraq. Now, I would suggest to you strongly that it would be beneficial if British troops were to stop being in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and if we tried to support what's left of the United Nations. Terrorism is just a construct. There's a trial going on at the moment where the jury didn't agree. You've been reading about it, maybe in the North, to do with British fascists. You know, supposed to have created explosives. Anybody read about this trial? Yeah. It's just a construct. It's a silly word. I think we're playing a game by using even words like terrorism. It's like talking about witches when there are no witches. The real issue is that there are British troops and lots of British mercenaries too, far more than British troops in Iraq. Let them leave immediately. And similarly with troops in Afghanistan, it is a priority, just like it was a priority for Italian fascist troops to leave Ethiopia. And in fact, they did leave 5 years later. Thank you very much.
Do you want to start off with that one?
I'll just make a quick point. I mean, I'm certainly not suggesting that we should accept that British troops should stay in Iraq or stay in Afghanistan. That wasn't my argument. Wholly agree with you. I think you made the case extremely well that getting our troops out of there is of utmost urgency, and I'm with you on that. I guess what I was trying to say was that I think within the opposition or the dissenting kind of movements, there is this focus, and you're right, terrorism is a construct. I think that's what I've tried to show. Terrorism is a construct. It's something that has been created in many ways, fostered in many ways, by the existing structures of power, and it serves their interests. And obviously, I think I've already made clear what my stance is on that. Yep. No, fair enough. But that's on the issue of Iraq, yes, absolutely. But my point is, we need to move beyond just, is that where the buck stops? I mean, this is what the anti-war movement, the left movement, have been doing in this country. Let's get out of Iraq, or let's get out. They've forgot about Afghanistan. We've always been, and I'm relatively young, I don't even know what was going on like a couple of years ago, but we're very single issue. When it was Kosovo, it was, let's get out, we don't like Kosovo, get out of Kosovo. When it was Bosnia, it was like, we're messing around in Bosnia. Now it's Iraq, it's just get out of Iraq. We're kind of always reacting, but we need to be a bit on the ball here. And I think it's about not just pulling out, yes, pull out of Iraq, don't go for Iran, and let's look at why we're going into these countries and why the hell we've got, this is all going on. We need to look at the broader system and change that and direct attention to that. That's, I guess, all I'm saying. I don't think you disagree with me.
So you're wondering about the escalation of the, the methodology of the MI6 and CIA. It's not just a sort of political movement, but it's going very much like the fascist regimes.
I think it's a hugely important analogy, and one that has surprising parallels, because actually at University of Sussex, my doctoral research is on imperialism and genocide. So I'm actually doing comparative analysis of empires and genocidal strategy. And although it's not what I'm actually studying now, I'm not studying Nazi Germany closely. It's not part of my research. But I'm going to be looking at it. I already have a very clear idea of where we are. And I think once you look at the history and the way things have developed, there's a number of ways of looking at this. Firstly, there is actually culpability in the Holocaust. There is direct culpability and indirect culpability on the part of the Anglo-American elites. Might be somewhat difficult to pin down, but it's pretty clear that it's there. In addition to that, so it's not apart from that, in addition to that, you've got the chaos that was generated from 1945 to 1990. The figures for the deaths that were created, both through military interventions, covert interventions by the CIA, the United States, backed by Britain, and through the massive social engineering of countries to establish a free market system, there's a number of estimates. Direct deaths, according to J.W. Smith, who directs the Institute for Economic Democracy in California, he estimates that 12 to 15 million people were killed throughout in that process. And he says countless hundreds, millions of others will have died from the economic fallout of these processes. That is huge. But again, it's not part of our historical consciousness. This is something that I talk a lot about in my writing. The inability of our, as a society, culturally to recognize how deeply embedded we are in bloodshed, but always rather to look the other way and say it was those bloody darn Nazis, you know, if we hadn't fought them, we'd all be speaking German. And it's true, but it's not the whole truth, because we wouldn't be fighting them, arguably, if we hadn't been geopolitically playing our geopolitical intrigues in the first place. I mean, that's a case that can be argued and debated, but I think the point is that I think your point that we are living in a state where we have surpassed fascism. This isn't, fascism is the nearest analogy. This is something else, because fascism, some people say, you know, fascism is something you can see with the red flags, you know, but you can't see this. This is not in front of us. In fact, what we see is the flag of democracy, security, human rights. That's what we see waving in our faces, but that is not what is happening on the ground. Rather, we have, at the beginning of the talk, I just gave a coming, human trafficking of a huge scale, thousands of innocent people, tens of thousands, being picked up and put in detention camps and tortured. What the hell is going on? This is, again, going on now as we speak, and yet we think we're living in a democracy. Somehow we need to... There is already huge discontent. You know, people are already waking up. We've had panorama programs now about rendition. There is already, you know, amongst journalists as well, realization that something is fundamentally wrong. What we need to do is capture that vibe and find the right words, just the way the media do. The media, they're always playing these propaganda games. We need to play the information war back at them.
Thank you. I'm going to go to Kevin at the back there because he had his hand up. Two or three minutes.
Thank you. All right, Nafis, thank you. I wasn't political myself or actively political until about 18 months ago when I saw information about 9/11, which really shocked me. But since seeing that, I mean, I've become aware, you're asking about the extent to which the depth of these... forces and the subtlety of them and the breadth of them and the way it affects so much, not just of the world, but every aspect of our lives. I mean, I found myself moving towards information about the history of banking and the strategy for a one world government. And I've become very aware in my own job, I was teaching schools, and I've become very aware of how the very culture, the day-to-day minutiae of your life is affected by policies coming out of think tanks funded by bankers, which is keeping us all demented with pointless activity. Things like this. I mean, we are so affected on every level by the stuff that's coming at us, and it's very coordinated, it's very subtle, and from being a rather naive person, I think, you know, connecting these things is very hard work for ordinary people to begin to understand and accept things about terrorism, because it's you know, you're talking about us meeting and talking about it. Some people get it, but other people are just horrified. And I'd like your advice about, you know, whether you think the banking thing is significant, and secondly, whether it's really what you think is the best way to go about talking to people about these things.
I mean, obviously, banking is a significant, certainly it's hugely significant. You know, I mean, you need to understand the wider economic context. And certainly, I mean, I'm very concerned about the convergence. I mean, my colleague Graham Ennis is sitting there, very concerned about the convergence of multiple crises, economic crisis, ecological crisis, the energy crisis, all converging. And very much a system which is, actually, a system is very weak. A system is in a kind of a meltdown phase. And a lot of this is in a response to that. There's a number of things that are worth noting without going kind of off the mark and going into too much detail, because I know we're low on time. What is happening now? And a number of people have noted this. I know, for example, if you've heard of Emmanuel Wallerstein. Emmanuel Wallerstein, very well-known world systems theorist. He's a scholar at Yale University, sociologist. Very famously wrote after 9/11 about the Bush administration's policies. And even before then, he was writing about it. He was saying, look, since 1979, note the year as well, 1979, the global economy has been extremely weak. And specifically, US hegemony has been on the decline. And that decline phase is continuing. And he says, what is happening now with the Bush administration is not some kind of strength, you know, we're going to blast out there and suddenly just take over everything because we've got the power. It's because they're absolutely desperate. Because the existing institutions, the United Nations, World Trade Organization, the World Bank, existing framework of order was not sufficient to keep things rolling smoothly. There was too much dissent. And if you remember what was going on before 9/11, I remember when, it's probably very faded now for you, but if you remember when President Bush had first come out in public on his marching parade, and there was a huge crowd there chucking tomatoes at him in Washington. They hated him. And that 9/11 turned that all around. And this is interesting because prior to 9/11, there were these global marches were going on everywhere. It was the whole system was coming apart at the seams, seemingly. And I think that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a response of desperation. Now, how you deal with that in terms of who you talk to and what you do, I mean, I can appreciate there's so much to talk about. People don't want to hear it. But look at the way that the media, certain shifts in the media, now it's become accepted. Iraq war was basically a debacle. We messed up in Iraq. That's kind of become accepted. Now you've got a lot of the mainstream media kind of accepting that maybe we should pull out of Iraq. You know, maybe this isn't really helping. You even had a couple of Daily Mail articles saying this, and this is extraordinary. There is a shift in thinking, and that's because of one thing, this connect that people are now thinking that, wait a minute, you know, we're supposed to be in Iraq, you know, for first of all it was WMD, then it was democracy, and all of that's something to do with, you know, if we get out then we're not going to be helping people and it's all going to fall apart. But all of that's something to do with, you know, keeping us safe. And now people are thinking, well, are we really going to be safe? That's what we have to pinpoint, that if we carry on like this, we are going to suffer hugely. And that is the huge fear, that it's not anyone else. It's not just the darn Muslims who are a problem. It's going to be us who are going to suffer as a population in the West, going to have significant problems. And that's what we need to focus on, is that where this is going. Imagine if there is a huge conflict with Iran. Imagine if that takes place. It's all very well. You could be a right-wing nutcase and you could hate Iran. Fine. Do you really want to go in there, guns blazing, and nuke them? Because we're going to have nuclear holocaust and it's not going to be very nice. So what I think we need to do is direct people's attention, and people are going to be different. Some people are going to be really interested in the specificities of 9/11. Some people are going to be interested by the discrepancies about hijackers. Some people are going to be interested in that. Some people are going to be interested about what happened on the day, World Trade Center or standard operating procedures. Some people will think, what a lot of bollocks, this is insanity, I don't want to hear that. So don't talk about that. Talk about something that is relevant to them, that they will understand. Some people will be interested in other things, like you mentioned banking. Okay, just a couple of points. I mean, on the issue of Mossad, I mean, I'm very skeptical of the idea that you can separate the criticism of Al-Qaeda as a covert operations entity, for example, in many ways, and separate that off from the idea that there is a Mossad element. I mean, there was an even famous incident where, I don't know if it happened recently, it was reported in the Israeli press, where Israel had actually was involved in the financing of this so-called Al-Qaeda group within the occupied territories, and the whole thing was a farce, and it just was exposed. So there's no doubt that Mossad is, like any other covert intelligence kind of apparatus, you know, involved in these kinds of activities. In fact, if you look at Al-Qaeda, the number of intelligence services that are involved in different regions in this group is huge. It's, you know, you got people fighting each other who are supposed to be arch enemies, you know, fighting cold wars. You got Russian intelligence, you got Algerian intelligence, you got French intelligence, you got Spanish intelligence, you got, you know, and it's huge. And I've got no doubt whatsoever that there is a Mossad involvement. And on the issue of 9/11, again, I'm not going to say that this is not a fruitless line of inquiry. I would be open-minded about it. Even Fox News did an investigation, notoriously, on covert operations that were going on with Israeli intelligence operatives prior to 9/11, and there was some indication that certainly perhaps they may have had foreknowledge, blah, 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 blah. I'm aware of that. That's what they brought up in the Fox News investigation. We shouldn't avoid... I understand. You're right. People are... No, I agree with you. People are avoiding Mossad. But to
argue
that...
I think most people in this hall are aware of Mossad, as of all the other intelligence agencies. Oh, we have. We've had a whole meeting on...
Can I have the last word on this?
On Zionism, which you weren't at.
I just want to say, basically, one... I mean, my basically general perspective is that we shouldn't... Any line of inquiry should be investigated. Doesn't matter how ludicrous it appears. As an academic, I think any line of inquiry, you should investigate it, and it's fine to investigate that and see where it leads you, and that includes Mossad, but that doesn't mean once you include Mossad, then everything else is rubbish. I don't agree with that. You quoted Hamid Gul, yeah, and I know people who even know people who know Hamid Gul. Hamid Gul is a corrupt liar. He is not the evidence you want to prove a Mossad connection.
Okay.
Hamid Gul is crazy guy. This guy is a really dangerous guy. There's other evidence which is much more credible than quoting Hamid Gul about Mossad.
Hi, my name's Paul Stott. I'm one of the editors of the anarchist newspaper Class War and Notes from the Borderland magazine, which I know a few people here would have read. Nafees, I thought you sketched very accurately the United States and America's interests and conduct. What I perhaps didn't get when I saw you speak last year at the Islamic Center was anything along the lines of the objectives and the interests of Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Iran. Because I think it's important to say that those countries at the very least wish to be regional powers or to have a dominant position within Islam and within politics. And is there not a danger that we're missing out on something by not giving those countries the same sort of attention? I mean, you sketched on the possible involvement of one of the Saudi princes in 9/11. And just as the West can play a double game with these countries, perhaps those countries are playing a double game with us.
I think it's an important perspective. The reason I tend to focus on our side of the story, and that's a decision I've made, and perhaps it's not an entirely holistic perspective, but I'm going to stick to doing that, is simply because I think we do not have enough self-criticism and self-awareness and self-reflection in our political culture. It's very easy to look at Iran and say, the bloody Iranians doing it all over again. Bloody Saudi. I mean, to be honest with you, that's what we hear all the time. The Saudis are doing this, the Iranians are doing that. So that's why my tendency is to focus on what we're doing and, in fact, how we're complicit in what they supposedly are doing. In fact, what they're doing often is very much what we've asked them to do. There's no doubt that the Saudis and the Iranians, I would emphasize, however, that while there is an element, if you read, say, the work of Saeed K. Aburish, the Palestinian author, his historian based in London, A Brutal Friendship, very, very good. This is one of the best historical overviews of British and American foreign policy in the Middle East. The problem is, you see, is that with the Saudis, with the Pakistanis, not just with those, with every single Middle East client regime, all of these entities were created by the British, by the French, by the Americans. They didn't actually exist prior to... This is something many people aren't aware of. They didn't actually exist. Saudi Arabia didn't exist. Iraq didn't exist. Kuwait didn't exist. Jordan didn't exist, blah, 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 blah. They literally carved up the Ottoman Empire. They drew lines how they thought, and they just put it up. They set it up like that, and they created a situation where they were actually planning conflicts, internal conflicts, international conflicts, as early as 1916, the Sykes-Picot Agreement on the oil and blah, blah, blah. So to some extent, I'm skeptical of the... there is a deep political extent to which ideologies within these nations are being, even to this day, manipulated by Western state power. Now, I could understand as well the perspective that maybe I'm taking that too far. I do think that Iran, certainly, I don't have any kind of sympathy for the current Iranian regime. They've got significant problems. They're not completely non-democratic. That is also, again, a huge mistake to say that. They do have a functioning democracy. They've got a huge electoral base. But they have practiced very, very egregious human rights violations, against free speech. But hey, We're doing the same thing here on a vast scale, but yet this is legitimate, and over there we have to go and invade them and take over. So that's my concern. Iran does have imperial ambitions in the region. It wants to extend its power in Iraq. It's trying to consolidate its control. But again, how far does this go, and how much is this prompted by the regional politics with Israel and Iran, the drive towards nuclear weapons? When, you know, Ayatollah Khamenei is actually given a fatwa saying that, and he's not the first leading, the word is marja, leading guy who can give a legal ruling, to say this, that nuclear weapons are haram, forbidden in Islam because of their indiscriminate nature. So that's why a number of people are very skeptical, people who understand Shiite thinking, Shiite theology, are skeptical of the whole notion that they want to develop nuclear weapons, because it's not actually legitimized by the mainstream theology that even the majority of Iranians follow. So there's a lot of question marks here about the extent of these ambitions. Pakistan, I've got no doubt whatsoever, with Saudi Arabia, have an ambition to recreate a pan-Islamist kind of entity. That I don't think there's any doubt about that. And that's something that coheres with this ideology that has been associated with Al-Qaeda. But again, I would hasten us to look at the material infrastructure for this ideology, where it comes from, the intelligence services, what gives it a global ability.
Thank you.
Sorry. I think this meeting's been really great, but what I think we're doing wrong is that we're emphasizing the role of the Americans too much. Because yes, the Americans are really important. What we've got to say is that this is how the whole economic system of the world works. Like if it wasn't America invading Iraq for the oil, it would be Russia, as we've seen in Chechnya, where there are at least a limited amount of oil right on Russia's doorstep. They've invaded there. So if it wasn't America invading Iraq, it would be somewhere like Russia or China. And basically it's global capitalism. Basically producing for profit and not people who actually need the stuff. So you can get a $500,000 car in China, but you can't get food there.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I think this is a very crucial point. Just briefly, I think you have to do a structure agency approach. You have to look at both the agents within the system and the system itself and how they interact. That means looking at the United States and Britain and Western Europe as key actors within a system. But that's what I'm trying to get at, is that if you look at the way Al-Qaeda has functioned throughout this period of time, it's being functioned in the service of these specific interests and largely to control energy resources. Again, there is this question. So it does come down to what you're saying is there is a system that is geared to meet the interests of certain states in particular and certain interests who have power over those states. You're looking at huge corporate lobbies, you're looking at banks, blah, blah, blah. So again, you look at that wider system. And I think, you go back to what Graham was saying, you have to have that holistic perspective. You're looking at the economic system, you're looking at the political structure of that system, you're looking at its energy infrastructure. How is it working? You know, this obsession with hydrocarbon energies, which is doing two things. One is creating an energy crisis that is going to be very difficult to solve, and two, creating a climate holocaust scenario that, I mean, Graham could give you more details on that, which is actually 10 times worse than what the government is talking about. And what they're doing now is actually putting all the brunt on the public and saying, yeah, you know, let's do some road taxing and, you know, people have to pay more money and maybe we should stop buying bottled water at restaurants. I mean, come on. I mean, let's get serious. That's not what you do in a crisis. I mean, give people the option. There's no investment, millions of dollars that they're investing that are being lost. Imagine the trillions of dollars that are being lost in covert operations, literally lost. We can't account for them. We don't know where these have gone, supposedly, in black ops. And obviously, you know, conspiracy theories don't exist, but there's trillions of dollars going in black ops. And what's going on here? Why, you know, where is this money going? What would happen? Just think, what would happen if you invested that in thinking about renewable energies, or invested that in solving the problems of world poverty? I'm just being very, very kind of millenarial and, you know, imagine a brighter future. But the point is that the resources are there. It's a question of getting to a position where we can make people realize that and make people realize that we can do it.
Nafiz, thanks for your great talk, putting all in perspective. A couple of thoughts occurred to me in terms of moving the message kind of more mainstream. One is, wouldn't it be brilliant to have something which had the impact of loose change but was about geopolitics? And I'm sure it's possible. I don't know how it would happen. And I don't know if you know people who could make something like that happen, but that would be great. The other is, there is a book called Addicted to War by Joel Andreas, which is essentially a comic.
Yeah.
And it's just as good as William Blum's Rogue State, but it's 40 pages long and full of pictures. And that's something, again, which, you know, not to try and tell you what to do with your work, I know you're an academic, but it's something which might be of use. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is what we need to develop ways of accessing the mainstream. It's a really difficult thing to do, but I think people are doing it. I mean, I think a lot of you guys are doing huge work trying to do this, trying to find ways to reach a mass market audience. And it's going to, in the day, DVDs, you know, things that are going to appeal to people, things that are, what we're looking at is something which can give it, you know, you want sound bites, and you want to play, the key thing is to play the game. Look at what the information system is doing. We need to, one of the things that we're not very good at, and this is something we need to think about, is how to look, the media's always playing us. They're always playing us. They're always coming with sound bites. And the mistake that we've made as a movement, and I'm talking about all of us, you know, 9/11, left, you know, Greens, all the rest of it, is how we can do the same thing, how we can access what people are thinking about and get something that is really cool. We need to do something like that, and perhaps we need to just sit down and talk about it. You know, sit down and actually brainstorm and have a session where let's think about our media strategy, what we can do. That's the first stage.
I've got two quick questions. Firstly, what do you think's the end game of the British and American strategy? And secondly, as a comment, it seems to me that the US strategy for the last 50 years, starting with Iran in 1952, the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh, and is to defeat, you know, totally destroy leftist secular forces in the Middle East and build up Islamic power. Because everything America does strengthens the Islamic groups. Because, like, how strong is, like, Iraq? Is the left forces now, they're virtually non-existent. Like, they used to be strong, but that seems to be the secret game. But also, what's the US and Britain final end game? And as a final comment, I've read the book by Guido Ferrara, Conjuring Hitler. It's a brilliant book. I recommend everyone reads it.
The end game is the end game is pretty horrible scenario. I mean, I can't. The way things are going now, you're looking at about 10 to 15 years, and we'll start seeing real signs in our lives of these crises hitting us. And Western states are fully aware of how shit things are going to get. And their view is, well, rather than saying let's change the system and we lose our power and we lose our profits, we just strengthen it. And we put the burden on the people themselves, and they will suffer. And the worst case scenario, an absolute worst case scenario, and this is just a scenario, this may not happen, I don't know if the war with Iran will actually happen, because there is conflict within the administration on how to deal with Iran, but if it does, from what I can see, the trends in this country and the trends abroad, there are multiple theaters of war now again in the Muslim world. Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine, at least. There are others as well. Those are theaters of major conflict. Within the Western countries, there is this parallel process where ethnic minorities in general, and also specifically Muslim communities, are overwhelmingly being viewed as a fifth column. You know, now it's doctors. Doctors can be terrorists. Students can be terrorists. It could be anybody. It could be your neighbor. And there is this stoking of fear going on, and there is this deliberate exploitation. Even Rachel North, on her blog after the last incident, she was like, you know, why? They've raised the level to critical. And she quoted this really interesting BBC article about how they changed the alert level system in Britain in 2006, and they created the system. And this Whitehall insider said, the journalist asked the insider, what are people supposed to do when it gets critical? And he says, be very worried. And she was like, be very worried. What the hell is that supposed to do? You're doing the job of the terrorists. Do you know what I mean? We're supposed to be being solid and strong, not being worried. That's not helpful. So there is this very clear, you find the slips there, that there is this exploitation, quite deliberately, getting people scared. My concern is that if the war in Iran takes place, with the contingency planning that already exists, the legislation is there in this country and in the United States, in a nuclear war, that they could really crack down and end up doing mass internment of large sectors of the population. I don't think they're going to go back to the same. They're not going to become Nazis and do wholesale rounding up. They're still going to do targeted, but it's going to be in the thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands. Remember, for example, the Japanese in the United States, not exactly on the same scale, but still quite huge numbers. That's my concern. It could be that I'm utterly paranoid and I've just need to take some medication. But unfortunately, that I don't think so. I'm really concerned because I'm looking at the 1930s. The same thing that was happening in the 1930s is happening. It's the same thing, and almost the same ideology, that we had a global economic crisis of the capitalist system accelerated in Germany. The Nazis came to power, and they demonized the Jews. They said, these people are the problem. They are the parasites inflicting our body politic. And this is the concern I've got. Genocides always occur like this. That there is a social crisis, there is a bifurcation of communities, and there is a blaming process that outsider communities then take the blame for the brunt of that. And it's not just the Holocaust. And I'm seeing the same processes here, and that's what I'm concerned about.
My name is Fiona Weir. This is the first of your meetings I've been to, and I've found it extremely interesting. As a member of the Optimum Population Trust, I'd like you to put into the equation the problem that we already have with overpopulation and the terrible problems it's going to cause in the future. I think I would...
Let the lady finish. Just let her finish. Let her have a say.
I would like you to, if you have time amongst all the other things, to look up the OPT's website. And they've got some really fantastic statistics.
Sorry, my own comment on that is pretty simple. I mean, the figures that I've read latest projections on population. Most of them say that the population will rise to an absolute maximum of 9 million and then start going down again by itself. I don't believe that because, again, if you look at the global distribution of resources, the reason that you have more people in poverty is not because there are too many people, it's because our economic system is unjust. And there needs to be massive redistribution of resources. There is a huge amount of wealth. Unfortunately, it all belongs to Bill Gates. Let's go get him.
Hi, nephews. I'm Nick Collinstrom. And like you, I'm an academic who is skeptical of the 9/11 story. We've recently had headlines about the court judgment of the July the 21st bombers. Long, very expensive court case, and we've seen a whole lot of headlines about the terror threat to Britain and how it was just averted and how these monsters could have blown up our tube lines again. Well, Nafiz, I bothered to go to that court case. I spent a day there, and I heard this Muslim man speaking very clearly about how his Islamic religion would not permit him to kill anybody, but his conscience did impel him to do something about the war in Iraq, and he wanted to make a gesture. And he wanted something that would alarm people in the tube, something would go bang. And these lads were, I have to say, they were rather thick. I've got to say that. They're a bit thick. And they thought that if they got some chapati flour together and some hydrogen peroxide, mixed it together, and put electric current from a battery through that, then it would go bang. And they tried to do that. They went on tubes with this stuff, and actually it didn't go bang. Nothing went bang. But if it had, people would have ended up with some chapati flour on their faces. That's all that would have happened. It's not something that could be called a bomb. Now, I was rather baffled the next morning after this very clear exposition in a court with a whole lot of journalists and a whole lot of people with wigs to see the headlines all about this monster threat to our culture. And there was a whole huge block of flats that might have been blown up because that's where they were storing this chapati flour. I'm really baffled by what the media reporters were doing and how they could interpret the case in that way. I mean, this is an angle on, it's synthetic terror, it's what you're talking about, synthetic terror, but a nitty-gritty level, how are journalists made to accept this absolute codswallop?
I think you've said it. I've managed to get hold. I don't think it's online anymore. I'd managed to somehow track down the EU judgment when one of the guys, I think it was Hossein Osman, when he had gone to Italy and he was going to be extradited back. And the EU judgment included details on precisely what was contained in this so-called bomb. And it wasn't a bomb. I agree with that. It was not way a bomb. It was basically, it listed ingredients in detail, flour, nails, something else. I mean, I could do that now and mix it all up and then throw it at someone's head and they'd get damaged because it hit their head, but that's it. I'd probably get convicted then of trying to plot an alcohol. Fair enough. I mean, I think it's a good point, and I think there is it's certainly a pattern. There is a pattern. Now we can see this is not the only... Every single... Since 7-7, 7-7 was a catastrophe, but since 7-7, we've had... Every single plot has been an amateur plot. And it's very difficult to make sense of. And I've discussed this. I've discussed it with Graham. I've discussed this with Nigel Wilde, who I mentioned before. And it seems very clear to us that a lot of what's going on is you have the Pakistani ISI. They keep coming up. They keep coming up. They're involved with these networks, recruiting these guys. And there is, I suspect, a very possible process of deliberate police operations, intelligence operations, to draw people in where they can then be criminalized. In other words, entrapment. Entrapment was the word that was used by an ISI official speaking to the Pakistani's correspondent of Asia Times when describing the liquid bombs plot. So a lot of people will be absolutely shocked at the idea of entrapment. You don't have to be a deluded out there maniac to believe the police might entrap you. I mean, you just have to go back to Northern Ireland. And the history is there that when you have these kinds of conflicts, this could be happening. This is just my off-the-record speculations. I don't have any proof. I wouldn't stand by it, you know, because there is a court system there, I didn't go to the court system. I haven't read the document, so I could well be wrong. So I have to make that very clear. I wouldn't take this as anything firm. However, I think what we've heard today raises sufficient questions that we have a lot to doubt about what the games that the police and the media are playing.
But when it comes to false flag attacks within this country, you said something to the effect of, oh, I'm merely suggesting, and even parts of your book were blacked out because you didn't want to overstep that mark because you're a professional, you're a professor, you teach in West Sussex. I understand
not
that.
Not a professor yet.
Yeah. So, I mean, I am from the other end. I am from London. I was going to work that day, and the fourth bomb is my testimony. I'm not going to pull no punches. If I said, well, Haseb Hussein, if I knew where his family lived, I've already drafted a letter because I want to just give them my condolences, because there's no way he destroyed that bus from where I was standing on the lower deck. So it's things like that. You have to stand up. It's all right being political and being very... obviously, you're academic, so you actually understand that you have to be careful with what you say because people take you seriously. Well, if people take me seriously, that is the struggle which I'm now fighting. I've got a book released. I've got the website, which has been dropping for the past few months since last summer, and that's all I can do. I can just stand up and say, this is what happened from where I saw it.
Let him announce his book properly.
The fourth bomb.
The fourth bomb. And your name is?
Daniel Abuchike.
Okay.
Just Google fourth bomb and you'll get him.
Hello, Nafiz. Hi. And everybody here. I'd like to sort of address the point about sort of a worldwide movement and taking on the media. There are executives in media organizations who are starting to become aware of exactly the problem of sort of media and police and governments all seem to be on the same side and not on our side. To the extent that we can, joiningthedots.tv is all about connecting people and providing a view of the world that you don't get from mainstream television. It came out of the success of Loose Change 2, with loose change final cut, we will, I think, energize people to really ask questions. But I would say to you all that there is a sense that amongst media executives that we have been hijacked, and some of these media executives really do want to make a statement. In September, you will see Join the Dots relaunch. It's going to be supported by the independent newspaper. We've got 80 fantastic documentaries ranging from all sorts of different points of view, from the political right down to the very personal. You know, we're not particularly preaching any one point of view. We are just saying that in order to, for people to understand the world or get a coherent view of the world, they need information that they can readily access. When we meld print and broadband media together and add interactivity, our sense is that this will energize people. It will give people the opportunity not only to have their say, but also to connect with each other so that they can actually take on politicians, they can take on mainstream media, and they can demand that we regain the control that we deserve as taxpayers and voters, who, frankly, are the ones that really matter. So, you know, whilst I'm utterly scared that Michael Chertoff's prediction of a massive Al-Qaeda attack over the summer is likely to happen, until such time as it does, then, you know, take some solace from what some of us are trying to do. And I can promise you that there are some very senior people in some very senior media organizations who are kind of with you. They can't sort of speak out in the way that I can, but there are some vestiges of hope.
Was it Join the Dots TV?
Joining the Dots. joiningthedots.tv, but it's okay. Relaunching in September.
Okay. Thanks
That's
for that.
That's great. Thanks, Tim.
Shane Collins from Lambeth Green Party. Just want to thank you very much for that talk and The agenda you made clear with the government, in that there seems to be basically the government saying to the Islamic population, you sort out your extremists, and rather forgetting that we as the resident white population are not really sorting out our own extremists, which are of course the government and people involved in these illegal wars. So I want to pick up the point you made about the sort of the energy crisis and peak oil, and just ask you what you think the effects of peak oil and presumably, you know, the recession that comes with peak oil. I think a lot of us think that probably will be the case. And obviously, three depressions in a row equals a depression. And also the date. You know, you mentioned sort of 10, 15 years. I must say, a lot of geologists I've been reading suggesting more like 5 years at the most. So really just a question, what you think the sort of social ramifications of peak oil will be in Britain?
Yeah, peak oil was a pretty significant issue. My perspective on peak oil is actually slightly more pessimistic. I think we've already passed the peak. That's because most of the major oil-producing countries are now producing less every couple of years, and it's getting worse. Despite the Saudis pumping up their estimates, saying, yeah, we've got 700 million, you've got a couple of insiders saying, actually, it's declining, production is declining, and it's not going to get any better. Even Hugo Chavez, you know, has now come out and said, you know, peak oil is a serious problem. Venezuela's already, probably already peaked. So even in the mainstream left now, there is a kind of recognition of this. And it's interesting, the oil companies are still in denial. BP has issued its report. I don't know if you saw it. It was the other 2 weeks ago, I think, 3 weeks ago, the Statistical Energy World Review. And they said, don't worry, we've got 40 years left at current rates. And someone kind of asked, but current rates are going to increase. Current rates of consumption are going to increase. So what about that? There's no way we've got 40 years left. The conservative estimates coming out from people like Colin Campbell and others, I think they're credible. I think they are independent. The oil companies are fighting them. Governments are denying what they're saying. And they're basically saying you've got 2 to 4 years before we actually reach a peak. But I honestly think that they're being optimistic, and I think they're deliberately being optimistic in their public statements for certain reasons. But that's just me. I mean, you've heard me, and I'm paranoid enough as it is. But I think it's a serious issue. I mean, and the effect is going to be devastating. The effect is going to be economic decline. It's also going to affect the food industry, the agricultural industry, which by itself, you've got agribusiness experts saying by itself, the design of the food industry, agribusiness industry, is so ridiculous, it's so exhaustive of the soil, that it's going to peak in a couple of years. In fact, some people are saying that it may have peaked 1 year ago. And things like there's a consensus emerging now that we are facing multiple crises within this system. It's tied to the way it's structured economically. It's tied, which is also linked to the way it exploits nature, which is tied to the way it views nature as this endless resource that you can just continuously plunder for the gain of a few. But I think there is a rising tide of recognition that this isn't going to work. And the long-term measures that we need to think about, in the long term, it's easy to be pessimistic and to think, where is this going to go? Absolute disaster, apocalyptic scenario. Personally, I believe in God. I don't know if anyone else does. That's because I'm a Muslim. So obviously that will affect my optimism. people who have different theologies and things will obviously view things very differently. But that's no doubt makes me less pessimistic. I have a tendency to think that there is going to be something better at the end of this, and we have to work for that. Regardless of your theological, where you put yourself in a worldview, I think one of the things that we now know as a result of this system declining in the way it is, in this catastrophic way, the way that it's propelling us towards species annihilation, says two things. One, that the ethics and value system and ideology of this system do not correspond with nature, and two, they do not correspond with human nature. It doesn't connect. So there is something else. Our way of understanding nature, our way of understanding the way we work, doesn't fit in. Evolution isn't supposed to end with us completely wiping ourselves out. We're at a step now in our evolution as a species where we need to make a decision how we are going to live. How are we going to be? And I think that's what it's about. It's about big thinking now. It's about integrating ethics into our way of life, thinking local and global, thinking of how to live with nature ethically and not in a way that is going to destroy nature. And all of this, again, this is just me giving you sound bites. I'm not giving you anything meaty here, but this is, I guess, the general way I'm thinking, that we need to start thinking in that direction. And as much as there may be a drastic fallout, maybe there will be a nuclear holocaust, maybe there will be absolute death and destruction on the scale of millions. We don't know. Maybe there won't, maybe there will be. I think there may well be a huge fallout. It doesn't mean we should despair and say, that's it, I'm going to be depressed now, and what are we going to do? In fact, it means that we have to work harder to limit that fallout and to increase the likelihood that at the end of the fallout, we have something there, not just absolute catastrophe, that we have people, experts, activists, families who are saying, no, we've already thought about this, we saw this coming, and we're living it now. We've got a better way of life, a humane way of life, a just way of life, and we're living that now, and that's the future. So that's what we need to start thinking, building the future now. And if there is a fallout, and there probably will be, that there is going to be something at the end of it, a better civilization for everyone. That's basically my great statement for the future.
Nafees, just a quick couple of points. The first one, going back to that gentleman's point over there about the nuclear use of weapons on bunkers and such, what about the depleted uranium weapons that are being used right now to actually destroy Afghanistan and Iraq, and the fact that the Americans are using these weapons are going back to the effects of Vietnam with the use of BZ and Agent Orange, the fact that they're still creating deformed human beings to this very day. Going to Graham's point of forward thinking, this is very much forward thinking. We have to stop using these weapons. They're not traditional bullets. They're much more powerful and much more destructive.
The first point on DU, again, it's one of those things that we just don't have a clue of the way we've used DU. We've been using DU in every single major theater of war.
And the photographs are horrendous. I mean, you watch a stupid movie like Hills Have Eyes, and you have these mutated people. That's nothing. You have babies coming out. And one of the things that people don't think about is, as a society, what does that do to you? The trauma of mass aerial bombing campaigns, your children coming out, you know, completely unlivable. They die within in a couple of weeks. Those who don't die are on death's door. There's no medication. There's no water. What does that do to you? You know, what does that do to your consciousness? This is what we're not looking at. And that's something that we need to bring home to people here, that civilization, you know, Blair is talking about civilization. I mean, this is not civilization. This is completely the opposite of civilization. And if this is what the structure of our society is based on, we have to really start rethinking who we are, you know, and do something about it. And I think DU is part of that, because DU is one of those things that you have a lot of people focusing on it. It's a lot of specialized NGOs. It's one of those things that kind of they fall into the background. And one of the things I always like to say is that we are fighting nuclear wars in these countries. These are nuclear wars which are already happening. I actually wrote about this in my Iraq book, Behind the War on Terror. I talk about the use of DU in the Iraq conflict. And that's what I say, that this is a nuclear holocaust, but it's not being recognized as such. So under international law, DU is illegal, but we're still doing it. What can I say? Yeah.
Thanks very much, by the way. But just a very quick point. I've just finished reading Greg Palast's Madhouse.
Yeah.
He's very cleverly got hold of a bunch of oil company documents. But he maintains that peak oil is still a way away. That, in fact, Venezuela, if the price of oil goes high enough, has as much oil there as Saudi Arabia. It's an observation. I don't adhere to either any view. It's just... I'm very interested in getting the message out there. I've researched a lot into 9/11, and I've found one or two points of 9/11 that I can talk to people about and say, oh, yeah, but did you know? No, you're joking. Yeah, sure, just go and have a look at that. And that kind of spurs their interest in it. So you don't want to go... I really enjoy the detail. Basically, the towers. Who said that? Who asked? Towers going down in 10 seconds. That's the equivalent of 10 floors a second. You know, there's nothing to stop the floor above, you know, going down, and so on. WTC 7 going down. What? No, I didn't know about that. Yeah. So, and that kind of spurs our interest. I'd like to do the same thing with this. The reaction I get from people is they're scared and they don't want to understand this. So I'm interested in the kind of psychology of denial and kind of the psychology of loss, because they're losing something, they're losing their belief in the way they thought the world was. So I'm interested to research that about the way of communicating this. So I want to... Can you recommend a book that summarizes all that you've said today, that really puts it together? Then I can put together a story that's easy to tell people.
This is the chance for me to plug my book.
This is the War on Terror book.
I mean, if you're looking for stuff about this Al-Qaeda stuff, you might be able to find a paper I wrote online called Subverting Terrorism. You just do Nafees, Subverting Terrorism. I delivered it at a conference in Malaysia. And that was subsequently published in some book published in America. I think there's a copies available here as well. But you can actually get the document online. It's about 40-odd pages. So that's kind of like a summary. But if you're looking for like a book-length thing, my 7/7 book is a good introduction into it. And it's kind of like, it's very limited in what it does do. But it's a good introduction. It's a small book. I would, you know, it would be cheeky of me to recommend The War on Truth, because War on Truth is not an introductory book. It's a fat book. It's not that easy to read, partly because the print is so small. To be honest with you, I read it and it's like, well, I'm wading through turd here, reading it myself. You know, but I'm just being silly. It's a thick book. If you want to get the lowdown on everything I've been saying, that's the book to read. I mean, that's kind of my magnum opus. But if you're looking to get someone a quick, easy to read book, it's very difficult to find stuff on this because I don't know, there's not many people talking about this. So I guess start on that and then read around, see if you can find anyone else saying things like this.
I've got a question about the forward thinking that was already raised by one of the people in the audience. If another 9/11 is in the making to justify an invasion of Iran or Syria, then I think that's something we should be concerned about. We should be thinking preemptively. We can't prevent it, but at least do something about it. So, because there are clear indications, this NHS plot and then relentless propaganda, more racist than ever before, and then all these trials, convictions, and last week's Financial Times, an article about Iran's al-Qaeda ties, and this week Saddam Rushdie's honor being used as a pretext of al-Qaeda targeting UK. And the massive build-up on Iranian border and another USS carrier being sent to the Persian Gulf, all that looks like there are clear indications. I don't know whether that's going to actually be the case. There can be many scenarios, and they might end up deciding on one of them. But still, I think this is serious enough to be worried about. So I don't know what you would think about
this. There's different ways of doing it. I mean, one thing I've thought about is literally pumping up Seymour Hersh. Is just, you know, he's pretty highly respected, just pumping him up, sticking his face on a leaflet, New Yorker, CNN, quoting a couple of his statements. Headline, Bush financing al-Qaeda, from Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. Put it out there. Something we need to do is ask the frigging, get someone to answer in Parliament. What the hell does our government know about this? Because they know, they're actively complicit. We need to get someone to ask that question. And get this out there so that people, get it out there now so that people are aware that what's going on. If there's going to be an attack, where's the money coming from? Why have we been financing these guys? That's just one small angle. That's my particular focus. I'm sure you guys, people coming from different angles can think of different things. And again, your audience, who you're talking to, I mean, as the gentleman mentioned, you talk to some people, certain things pick their brain, other things, you know, you have to use different methods. Sometimes, if you're talking to someone else, sometimes they'll be interested in the different angles. So you have to think about who you're talking to and think about it like that. I just remembered I didn't answer the question about Venezuela. On the Venezuela thing, I mean, just on the PCOR thing in general, I don't think it's worth getting into a huge debate on here because it's a long topic. But it's really simple. I mean, Greg Palast's position, the multiple positions are, you get these people I call lunatics, people who deny that there's any such thing as peak oil at all. It's just physically impossible that you have eternal oil. They talk about a theory called abiogenesis that a bunch of Russian scientists came up with, was the idea that oil can replenish itself. It's not peer-reviewed. No one else has replicated it. I would love it if it was true, but there's no evidence for it. The other debate is basically how long will it take? 100 years, 40 years, 10 years? Now, just depends what you look in the literature. The consensus now that I can see amongst independent oil industry experts is definitely within 10 years. And my looking at the data myself, I think it's even worse. What they'll talk about is the parity between conventional oil and unconventional oil. Everyone knows conventional oil is peaking. No one's actually denying that specifically. You comb someone down. Conventional oil, which is the oil that we use now, the cheap oil, certainly has reached a plateau stage. The decline is going to come in a while. What then debate is about is unconventional oil, shale, tar sands, which is very difficult geophysically to get out of the ground. And basically, technologically, it's not happening. You go and look at what Shell is desperately pumping the PR. You know, we're going to do $11 a barrel. And it's not working. They're burning hundreds of millions of natural cubic meters of natural gas to get one barrel of oil out. And it's just not working. That, from what I can see, I would love to believe that peak oil is not real, because then at least I'd be one thing less to worry about at night. But it just doesn't seem to be that way, unless we come up with some wonderful technological fix.
I think that's probably where we have to end, Nafis. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Terrific evening.